Committee of the House Resources Committee to order. It's, as I say, 1:03 on Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013. Present with us this afternoon, Representative Johnson, Representative Tuck, Representative Hawker, Co-Chair Feige, Vice Chair Representative Wilson, Representative Seekin, and myself, Representative Sadler's co-chair. I don't see Representative Josephson here. Anybody else? Okay, very good. Before we start, I have a little demonstration thing. Please turn off your cell phones, because if they ring and go off during the committee meeting, you will owe the committee apples, Honeycrisp apples. There's samples here. They're delicious. No, I'm not the serpent, and no, this is not the Garden of Eden. Having heard from the Department of Fish and Game and Natural Resources, today's overview is the Department of Environmental Conservation. It'll be the last in our series of overviews of the committees that fall under the purview of the Resources Committee. And I'm pleased to have the Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hardig here with us, and several of his division directors, some of whom I know, some of them have not met yet. So welcome, Commissioner, to the front. If you would like to introduce yourself for the record and give your brief overview, and then call your division directors up to make their divisional presentations, that would be great.
Well, thank you, Chairman Sadler. It's a pleasure to be in front of the House Resource Committee again for the DEC overview. My name is Larry Hartig. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Conservation. And with me today is our Deputy Commissioner, Lynn Kent. And Lynn, up to about a year ago when she became the Deputy, was the Director of the Division of Water. The new Division of Director of Water, now she's been there about a year, is Michelle Bonet Hale. Michelle's here with us. And then Kristen Ryan is our Environmental Health Director, and she's over on loan to EPA this year for a year. That'll last until about midsummer, and then she'll be coming back to DC. And meantime, Elaine, who also works for the Environmental Health Division, is her acting, and Elaine will be up here in a minute. And then Alice Edwards, to the right of Michelle there, is our Air Quality Director. Behind her, Larry Dietrich, our Spill Prevention and Response Director. And then Tom Cherian is head of Director of our Admin Services Division. So that completes the management team at DEC. So a quick overview. I'd like to talk a little bit about our mission, and then I would like to, again, just talk a little bit about our divisions and some of the challenges and opportunities to the department. And I'll try to keep this short, about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll take, if it's okay with the chair, then we'll just go through the divisions in alphabetical order.
Right.
Good. No PowerPoint from me, so, but those are coming. Our mission, simply stated, is to protect human health and the environment, and it informs everything that we do. It's driven by good science, good engineering, and we try to also have good public process. It's very important to me and to the department. And how would I measure success? The way I'd measure success for the department is, are we providing Alaskans with healthy air to breathe, good clean water to drink, good sanitation? Do they have good drinking water, good drinking water systems? Is there good management of waste? If there's a spill, is it cleaned up timely and properly? All the things that I think that people expect in their living environment to be protected on, and have government there to assist them. We look closely with local communities. We cover, of course, the whole state. So when we say drinking water, that's going to be a lot different than in a village than it may be in Anchorage. But we operate in both. Also, in doing our jobs, a lot of the programs that we have start with the federal government under one of the environmental acts, whether it's the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, CERCLA, on. And some of the authorities that we have for running these programs actually come from the federal government. They're either delegated to us or we're authorized to run the program. And some of those big programs that we've taken over from the federal government, of course, is the NPDES, National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or APDS program, as we call it in Alaska. And that's the wastewater permitting program for any discharges to water the state or waters the United States that of pollutants that would require a permit from us that would otherwise come from EPA. We took a final primacy of that program. It came into us in phases. We took the last phase, the oil and gas phase, last October. So that means at this point the state has the whole program. Now, EPA still has oversight. They can come in and veto our permits, or they can take our program away from us if we don't think we're operating it correctly. But we have that program, and the way I like to put it is we continue to work to mature that program. Our air quality division issues permits, too, under the Clean Air Act. Again, that's a program that came to us from EPA on the federal side. That program is mature. We've had that now for several decades. The governor introduced a bill, it's House Bill 78, Senate Bill 27, that explores and potentially seeks to obtain primacy for the 404 program. That's the dredge and fill program that's currently run by the Corps of Engineers. That's similar along the lines of the way we pursued primacy of the 402, the wastewater discharge program. Interesting enough, it's EPA that has to approve that delegation of the 404 program to the state. Besides those delegated and authorized programs, there's a number of programs that we have where we basically share authority with the federal government in different ways. The one big one I'd put in that category is spill prevention and response. We're joined at the hip with the U.S. Coast Guard. We work with them almost daily around the state on spills, potential spills to marine waters. And Larry Dietrich, our SPAR director, will be talking about some of that, some of the things we do with the Coast Guard. We're also joined closely with EPA on, you know, any kind of discharge to land. We also working with the new federal agencies, BOEM and BESI, that used to be parts of MMS before it got split up. There, they also regulate oil and gas infrastructure. They have some of the larger pipelines. We have some of the smaller pipelines, but we need to work together. Now, some of the challenge and opportunities, budget, all of us have budget challenges. We can't ignore those. We know there's declining oil production in the state. Federal money is drying up. It's more competitive to get federal dollars. We're competing with more states to get the smaller dollars from that smaller pot of money. And so what it means is we have to be more efficient. We have to really look at our priorities, and we're constantly doing that as a department. The governor has an initiative that he announced at the start of his administration that's loosely called permit reform. In my mind, you know, that's efficiency and getting your priorities right. As you have less money to spend on things, how do you make yourself more efficient? And how do you make sure you keep those priorities right? And again, going back to our mission, I see our priorities are those basic needs, you know, clean air, clean water, good sanitation, good drinking water on top of any kind of spill, good cleanup. So that's what's driving us. Now, some of the permit reform items that you'll probably hear about from the divisions, just some examples of what I'm talking about. On the food safety side, which would be in our environmental health department, we looked at some of the types of foods that are typically served that really don't pose risk to the public. And so why are we regulating these? Why are we doing inspections and on and on? And so we went through a regulatory process this summer, and we lightened the load on those kind of foods and those kind of people that produce it. And that's freeing up resources where now we can do more inspections of the more risky type things, you know, looking at, you know, whether it's senior citizens and, you know, the food that they get served in daycare centers, whatever, that we can look at some of the higher risk activities and shift our resources there. Some of the other examples in our facilities program, which is in our Division of Water, that's where through the Village Safe Water Program, Municipal Loan and Grant Program, we provide funds and oversight for the construction of water and sewer projects around the state, from the largest to the smallest communities. There, that our budget's been going down precipitously. It's been gone down about 60% or so in the last 8 years, and that's 75% federal funded, 25% state funded. And it's really difficult to see how the state's going to replenish that federal money that's being lost. So we're looking at other ways of delivering good water and good sanitation to rural communities. You know, how can we do it with different types of systems or different structures, if you will? And we're not the only state that's looking at this. You look at other states, they have infrastructure needs, too, with aging infrastructure. Even New York City, you read about, you know, their challenges there. So when we look, say we're looking at new systems, and you'll see a pilot program in our capital budget for this to further this pilot program, looking at new water and sewer system ideas in the state. We think there's realistic systems out there and methods of attacking this, because other states are doing it and seeing success too. So last challenge I'll talk about here, because I want to get into
just for the record, Representative Tara is here. All right, thank you.
Thank you. The last challenge I'll mention, and it's challenge slash opportunity, because it's a real opportunity, too, and I call this one the opening of the Arctic. And for purpose of this one, I'd say the Arctic includes the Aleutians and everything on the west coast and north and the Chukchi and the Beaufort. And what we're seeing, of course, is as we all know, with Shell and ConocoPhillips and others behind them, a real interest in exploration up there on the OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf. What we're also seeing besides this exploratory drilling is we're seeing more marine traffic. And that's either not just associated with that resource development, what we traditionally think about the Arctic, you know, the far north, but also it's ship traffic on the Great Circle Route going, you know, from the western United States and Canada over to Asia. And as Canada looks at further development of their resources, including the bitumen in the oil sands of Alberta and the coal in the western Canada and the western U.S., they need to move that to western ports, either the Seattle area or Vancouver or Prince Rupert. And then when it's shipped over to China or other places in Asia, it crosses right through the Aleutians, right under the Aleutians, or right through them by Unimak Pass. And so we need to think about this as we saw with Shell, these ships losing power or losing steerage and going up on and grounding, going up on the rocks, that's not an unusual occurrence in this state, particularly this time of year. And so that's a challenge we see, too, with the opening of the Arctic, warship traffic in the Aleutians. And so we're exploring ways of, again, partnering with Canada and even the Russians and other jurisdictions and mutual aid agreements and other ways of working with industry to try to approach the risks out there. And so Larry Dietrich, our SPAR director, will go into that in more detail. But that's my overview. Again, some of the divisions, our missions, and some of our challenges and opportunities in the department.
Questions for the commissioner before we go into divisions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. You mentioned that you were looking this summer, you went over what you had to be careful of, and that there were some foods that you weren't worried about. Can you just give us a real quick list of what you got rid of?
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair. What we did is, of course, this is a public process. And we'd had a lot of discussions, including with a number of legislators that are particularly interested in food safety, and had somewhat of a list of food items that we think are less risky. And the way we really look at this is how much processing is involved in the food and how much opportunity there would be for some contamination of the food, whether it's microorganisms or whatever. And so it's an informed decision. It isn't just what's convenient. It's actually a very informed, science-based decision. But it'd be some of the things that you're looking at, just like bake sales, political fundraisers is one, you know, things like this, you know, where it's less risky. And the reason it's less risky is because you have a pretty good idea who's preparing the food. And if something starts going wrong, you know who to go to talk to, and you know who was at it, and you can warn other people, and you have a way of tracking it and making sure that you can get your hands over the problem real quickly. As opposed, if you're getting something that may be going, is more widely distributed, that may even go into interstate commerce or get in a way where you can't track that food. Once it's sold, you don't know who bought it or where it went or who's eating it. And somebody may be sick over here and somebody over there, and you can't figure it out. That's what you don't want, is where you get a widespread situation where you can't track it back and stop it. And so but Elaine Leslie Floyd, our acting director, she can kind of get into some of the more details, but that kind of gives you our approach. And we can certainly give you a list if you'd like and provide that to the chair.
Representative Seaton, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, one thing that we've discussed and we've gone through was adopting primacy on a number of things, NPDES, and we're considering on 404. And there's often some confusion in the public as to whether the state standards will be less than the current standards. Can you just explain for the listening public, as well as any new members, what you're required to do under, if we accept primacy under one of these programs, as far as the standards that are enforced, and then what the benefit of primacy is?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. In the 402 program, that's the wastewater discharge program, in order to get primacy from EPA, from the federal government, they have to find that we have a comparable program. And it means the whole program. It means also the public process, the public's right to an appeal, that they have equal access to challenge our decisions. It's not just standards, but it's the whole program has to be comparable. That would be the same situation with 404, the wastewater, the dredge and fill program would have to be comparable for us to get primacy. In terms of the standards themselves, the state already, not just Alaska, but all states under the Clean Water Act, are responsible for setting standards. We already have that. That's independent of primacy. It's just under the Clean Water Act. But when we set a standard under the Clean Water Act, before we can use it, before it can become effective, it has to be approved by EPA. That's also federal and it's for every state. You can't waive that. It can't go away. EPA has to approve that. And so then they have to do Endangered Species Act consultation. If there's any ESA concerns, they'd have to do tribal consultations, Magnuson-Stevens Act consultations. So it's a pretty rigorous process for us to set a standard. We have to do that through our own regulatory process, subject to court review. And then EPA has to do its approval with and run the gauntlet on that side. And typically what we see on setting a standard, it could take 4 years or more. We have standards that have pushing 8 years just because it's a complex process, but it's the same for all states.
And follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and I guess as we considered some of the primacy issues before, the requirement was that the standards adopted by the state had to be at least as restrictive as the federal standard. Is that still kind of the overarching premise that we can have primacy, but the standards that we enforce have to be at least as tight or restrictive or however you want to say that as the federal standards?
Yes, again, Representative Seaton, through the chair, again, setting standards, it isn't something we got with primacy. That was something we got when the Clean Water Act was passed, and all states got it at the same time. We're the same as all the rest of the states in terms of setting standards. The EPA, though, does have requirements about how we set those standards. They have to protect what's called designated uses, and they have to otherwise comply with other provisions of the Clean Water Act. So if we proposed a standard that didn't meet the requirements of the Act, EPA wouldn't approve it, and we wouldn't be able to use it in permits. EPA does sometimes set expectations, guidance, standards, if you will, for particular classes, like say toxics or something like that, that they expect all states to follow. And then if a state tried to set a standard different than that, they might not get approved. But they don't go in there and tell the states, here's your standard for everybody, and neither do they state primacy. And at that point, the state take over standards. We just get it with the Clean Water Act. We don't have to apply for it.
Representative Wilson.
Just one question. If the state takes over primacy, perhaps we can move a little faster as a state than the feds could do it? Is that a big advantage?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, if we're talking about, we already have primacy on the wastewater discharge program under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. What the governor announced in his State of the State is he wants DNR and DEC collectively to explore and then hopefully pursue primacy of the Clean Water Act 404 program, which is the dredge and fill program. And some of the advantages, and I'm sure get into this in hearings on the House and Senate bills, so I don't want to preview that, because I'm sure if there's other questions on that, feel free to give those to us through the chairs. We'll make sure we cover those if I don't cover them today. But we are looking at, if we take primacy of any program, we want to do a better job, and we wouldn't be pursuing primacy if we didn't think that we could, again, provide a more efficient and a better service to the public. It doesn't mean, I don't want to slight the core in any way at all, but when you have local permit writers that are accountable to the public and there's more of that one-to-one relationship, more accessible, I think that it does cause more attention on productivity and customer service, if you will.
And Representative Feige has a question, then we'll let your commissioner, your deputy directors, your directors get up and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think from the permittee side of things, there seems to be certainly general agreement that the state having primacy in whatever area is certainly a benefit operationally to the state and to our industries that have to use the permitting system. But there are significant, although it costs us money to administer the programs, is there not a significant savings on the Fed's part? In other words, that we're doing a certain amount of work that they would have to do otherwise, and they're seeing a financial benefit for us picking up primacy in a particular area?
Representative Feige, through the your
group here. Or is it hard to quantify?
It's hard to quantify. I have to admit, I haven't seen the actual figures on that. I mean, I could come up with the figures of what the state spends on its program, and you say, well, that's what the feds aren't spending. But they do have oversight, again, of Alaska and the other states that have primacy. So there are still costs associated with it. As you go through the transition to primacy, one of the things that we would work out with the Corps that we worked out with EPA is to make sure there's a smooth handoff is we'd start working on permits together and collaborative. There'd be training. They would work with us on putting together our guidance documents. And there's a lot of work in getting primacy for them and us. So they would have to front load that a little bit. So I think in the initial years, I don't know that they would look at it as a way of saving money. But ultimately, I believe you're absolutely correct. It would save them money in the longer term.
And with your indulgence, I've got a short follow-up question on that. As we set down the road to potentially taking over the 404 primacy, given your experience in air quality and water quality, what's the likely timeline we're looking at?
It's a longer-term proposition. Co-Chair Sadler, you have to put together, I won't go through all the steps here, but just kind of give a general outline. We'd have to first have that initial consultation with the Corps and the people about there about what their resources are and what ours are to build out the program. Because you have to have that whole package together, which would be our regulations, how many people are going to be in the program, getting them hired, getting them trained up, get our guidance documents in order. All that has to be in place before they would hand it off to us. And so that would have to be very well coordinated with them. And as part of that, setting a schedule. And our experience with EPA was you do want to set a schedule. You do want to have it set with milestones. You want to identify the specific permits that are going to be worked on in that process so the state doesn't inherit an incredible backlog. You know, once the feds know that they don't have the program anymore, they may decide they have other priorities. We don't want that. We also want to be able to keep the permittees getting their permits in a timely way. So we can work all those out. My best guess, though, is that you'd be talking 5-plus years before there would be a handoff, total handoff of the program. It may go quicker, but I think that 5 years would be somewhat in the ballpark.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I look forward to having lots of discussion about this as the bill comes before us, and obviously we've got some important questions now. Given the time we have, which we've got about 24 minutes per division, if you want to spread yourself that far, but please call up your first division director.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon.
Representative, you got a quick question, you say? Or?
That's fine.
Okay, sorry. Proceed. Put name for record and go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Alice Edwards. I'm the director for the Division of Air Quality at the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Welcome
and
here.
I do have a PowerPoint for you today, albeit a rather perhaps a short one. The mission of the Division of Air Quality is to conserve, improve, and protect Alaska's natural resources and environment and control air pollution to enhance health, safety, and welfare of the people of the state and their overall economic and social well-being. Essentially, we work in the realm of air pollution and outdoor air pollution. We don't deal with indoor air pollution, but we do deal with outdoor air pollution. Our core services within this division, as the commissioner mentioned, we do issue air quality permits to industrial facilities that can release air pollutants We do compliance assistance and enforcement with regards to those permits. We also provide assistance to communities to help protect air quality within our communities. We do air monitoring and assess air quality for a variety of purposes. We often are reviewing and commenting on the federal rulemakings that come out for air quality, which happens pretty frequently, and try and bring Alaska's perspective to the table and, you know, and make sure that especially EPA, who we are most frequently getting rules from, understands when we have something special with regard to Alaska that we think they should consider. And then finally, we also develop air quality plans and help implement and enforce those plans to bring areas that don't meet federal air quality health standards back into compliance with those standards or to help them maintain them. These are generally plans that we work out with communities. The structure of the Air Quality Division, we have basically three primary programs within this division. We have the Air Permits Program, which really has the bulk of the staff. I believe more than half of our staff are involved in air permitting or air permitting compliance in some way. We also have a non-point program, which works a lot with communities, as well as a monitoring program. And then we have a small administrative support program for the division. A little bit on each of our programs. The air permits program, they ensure that emissions from industrial operations in the state don't create unhealthy air. So we're primarily looking at permitting industrial facilities to make sure that the air quality standards, the national ambient air quality standards, are maintained. And that we're not having significant degradation of air quality as a result of industrial activities. So they have two main kinds of permits that they work with. One is, we call them construction, well, there's the construction permits and our minor permits, which deal with new facilities or big modifications to facilities that already exist. We have permits for those. And then we also issue what we call our Title V air operating permits, which is Title V under the Clean Air Act. And those permits, operating permits, they gather up all the different permit requirements from the construction permits, all the applicable federal rules and state rules that apply to these facilities, and put them into one operating permit. This group also conducts the compliance assurance inspections, follows up if they find deviations with the permits, looks through the permit reports. There's a lot of self-reporting within the air permit program. Within this program, you know, the commissioner talked about permit efficiencies. Over the years, we've really taken a lot of time to try and make sure that we are being as efficient in processing our permits as we can and trying to be timely with permits. Air permitting is complicated. There's a lot of upfront work and to get the permits in place, and we want to issue them as timely as we can. So we do have an ongoing process within the division, our quality management system, to try and continue to find improvements and improve this program. And also within this program is are the staff that respond to a lot of the general air quality complaints and concerns that come in from citizens throughout the state. The non-point and mobile source program is a program that deals with more with non-industrial facilities. They partner with communities to basically maintain and achieve the ambient air quality standards. They've worked a lot with mobile sources, with motor vehicle requirements that have come from the federal government over the years. Things like the wood smoke concerns that we have in a number of communities. Those are the types of things that they work on. They do a lot of outreach and education on air quality issues to raise awareness and help encourage behaviors that are going to improve air quality. And they also are the group that help to develop the air quality control plans for communities that are having problems with air quality and making sure that those get incorporated into our state air quality control plan. And the communities that we have typically been working with as far as sort of formal air quality plans have been Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which have had air pollution concerns over the years for a couple of different pollutants. The other major group in the air division is the Air Monitoring and Quality Assurance Program. These folks operate and oversee our air monitoring network in the state. And the networks are designed to help assess compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. EPA sets standards for a number of pollutants. Typically, the ones that we've had the most concern with in Alaska have been carbon monoxide, although we've managed to bring Anchorage and Fairbanks into attainment with carbon monoxide over the years. The other big pollutant that is usually of concern in Alaska is particulate matter. So we have some required monitoring sites that are part of our core network that are a result of how the federal program is designed and looks at air monitoring and where monitors should be placed. And so Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and the Matsu Valley all have monitors that are ongoing, regular monitors, air monitors that are being operated to look at compliance with the standards. But we also do a number of special studies working with communities that may have concerns about air quality. So we also have done some monitoring recently in Seward. We have a monitor running in Galena in cooperation with that community, Fort Yukon in the summer for smoke from forest fires, Soldotna, and a few others. So we do have some other monitors that move around a little bit when we do special projects just to see what's going on in these other areas. This program also has our air monitoring auditor. So he goes out and he audits all of the monitors in our network to help make sure that they're all running in accordance with the federal requirements. This is also the group that issues air quality advisory. So when we're having an event like wildfire smoke is coming into the towns, or there's a volcanic event or things like that, they will issue air quality advisories to inform the public of hazardous air conditions. And then this group also assists with air permitting in the sense that they help look at the technical work, the air monitoring data, and the meteorological data that goes and stands behind some of the air permits. So the Division of Air Quality has a number of initiatives and challenges. I'm just going to walk through a few of these for you. And the first point I wanted to make here was that there's a distinct link between energy and air quality. Anytime we burn fuel, we end up with some air pollution emissions. And how efficiently we burn fuel really can make a difference in air pollution. One of the things that we've been seeing recently in the state in our communities is that the high price of fuel oil has really driven a lot of residents to turn to wood for space heating. And wood heating obviously produces smoke. We all know what wood smoke is. But in certain places, that can really build to unacceptable levels, creating health issues for people as particulate matter concentrations rise. And we have Fairbanks is a key example of where we aren't meeting ambient air quality standards, primarily as a result of using wood for space heating. So in general, cleaner burning, more efficient devices are very helpful in improving air quality, and also having cleaner burning and affordable fuel options can be very helpful in assisting with maintaining healthy air quality. One of the things I know that's being looked at quite extensively, there's a lot of discussion about energy now here in this building and elsewhere, but getting economical natural gas to interior Alaska would be very helpful to air quality in the Fairbanks area in particular. Trying to bring a cleaner fuel, hopefully economical fuel, to that area would be useful. Next, I want to talk a little bit about Fairbanks and their challenges. The Fairbanks North Pole area is an area where we're spending quite a bit of time and working quite extensively with this community. They are exceeding the daily fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, ambient air quality standard. They have been for a number of years, and we've been working with them quite closely on developing an air quality plan. That plan is actually passed due to EPA. It was due in December. There have been a lot of challenges trying to figure out what sorts of controls will be the best options for bringing that area into attainment with the standard, and we're working very hard to try and find solutions. But the plan and the control options have been very controversial. It's a large non-attainment area. There's a number of PM2.5 sources of emissions, but we know that home heating is a very important contributor to it, and we need to address that. So that's been very challenging, and it's something we'll be working on very hard during the coming year to try and get that plan completed. And in combination with that in Fairbanks, I would note that I'll talk a little bit later about how federal standards are always changing, but the federal government, EPA, just came out with the latest revisions to the particulate matter standards. So there's actually a new annual standard, which is a little bit more stringent than the prior one, and so that may be an issue for Fairbanks going on into the future. Fortunately, if we can resolve the daily issues and, you know, daily PM 2.5 issues in Fairbanks, we'll probably also solve the annual issue. I wanted to mention ongoing permit streamlining and process improvement a little bit more. We have a goal of always, as I mentioned, improving our consistency and timeliness of permitting. We want to have high-quality, legally defensible permits. We want to be able to improve the predictability of the permitting process, so we try to standardize things where we can while trying to provide flexibilities where we can and where it's needed. We do have a quality management system to try and enhance that consistency. It also helps us with training when we have staff turnover, which is pretty frequent. We're using standard conditions within our operating permits as well to try and improve the efficiency of issuing those permits. We do try to work fairly closely with our stakeholders to identify issues and solutions, especially if we see some sort of a consistent issue coming up, trying to work through those and figure out options that will work and allow things to move along. In the world of construction permits, a lot of the effort goes into pre-application work, trying to help the facilities and the companies that come in for these permits to have the appropriate data and information so that they're collecting it correctly, so that when they come in, their permit will get processed quickly and efficiently. We're also working to look at partnerships. We've been spending quite a bit of time looking at data for the North Slope. We have a lot of industry up there already. There's a lot of activity up there, so we've been trying to do some work assessing data sources, trying to fill data gaps, looking at partners to try and improve our quality models and the tools that we're using so that hopefully permitting up there will continue to go smoothly and maybe, you know, we can create some efficiencies there. In rural Alaska, we do hear about air quality concerns in rural Alaska. One of the primary concerns is dust, but we also hear about wood smoke in these communities, and sometimes we also hear about open burning. Particularly, you'll see burning at landfills, which can be problematic from an air quality perspective. And, you know, rural Alaska can be pretty challenging for us. The issues are widespread throughout the state, and it makes it really difficult to effectively respond to the needs of all these communities. But we do try to partner with communities that have interest, work with them to try and assess what their air quality concerns are, whether monitoring of those concerns is appropriate, or what we might do to help them work locally to improve the air quality in their communities. And then lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about new and revised federal standards and rules. The Air Quality Division is very much aligned with the requirements of the Clean Air Act. And under the Clean Air Act, the air quality, ambient air quality standards, the rules for implementing those standards are being frequently updated by EPA. And it can be quite difficult and challenging to keep up with all of the EPA rulemakings that are coming out and reviewing those proposals. Typically, we focus our comments on technical concerns or Alaska-specific issues that may arise in these rulemakings. And ultimately, we come back and adjust our program as needed to address those final rules. So a lot of the work we do is just keeping up with the ongoing federal requirements that come out. And I put a couple of examples up here for you. Engine standards. This is an area where EPA just recently published a new rulemaking related to engine standards, and DEC, ourselves, as well as Alaska Energy Authority, we've been talking with EPA for a number of years about rural Alaska and performance standards for engines, and there's actually quite a bit of flexibility that's been built into the EPA rule to try and address rural Alaska, particularly in the electric sector. So this is an area where working with EPA, getting Alaska-specific issues in front of them has been, we've had some success in actually gaining some flexibility within the national rulemaking for some of Alaska's sources. The lead in aviation gasoline is a new issue. EPA was petitioned on this issue from environmental groups to look at lead in aviation gasoline. That process is moving very slowly at EPA, but DEC has stepped forward very early in the process to alert them to the serious concerns we have related to the need to have of air transport in Alaska and making sure that whatever happens with regards to fuels for aircraft isn't going to be detrimental to the state. So these are the types of things that we work on. Sometimes we, for example, the one-hour nitrogen dioxide standard, it's up here. That's been really a challenging standard for us to implement. And in this case, we're really working with industry, working with EPA to try and find our way through the process of bringing this particular standard into our air permitting program. So lots of challenges on that front, but I think that, you know, our goal is to try and bring those concerns to the forefront of EPA and gain flexibility if it's needed for Alaska and or try and work through how we're going to implement them, implement the new rules here in the state. And I think that's where I was going to end.
Beautiful. Thank you, Ms. Edwards. Good. You covered a lot of territory. Appreciate that very much. A lot of questions are rising in my mind. We're going to get to a couple of them. First, Representative Wilson, then Representative Feige, and then Tuck.
As far as the air standards go, with the like I'm thinking about Fairbanks because there's a lot of wood smoke there, and there's people that are breathing that, and you know how dangerous is that just to be living there right now.
Well, the air quality in Fairbanks is failing to meet the 24-hour fine particulate matter standard, and the kinds of health effects you see with that, there's groups of individuals that are probably more sensitive than others, so people with existing respiratory conditions, people with cardiac conditions, are probably feeling the impacts of the air quality up there when the concentrations are high. And they're not high every day, but they're high for a good portion of the winter. And so that can have an impact on them. There's been scientific studies, health studies have shown there's premature death, so from exposures to fine particulate matter, respiratory issues. So there are true health effects from being exposed to that, but some portions of the population may be more sensitive to it than others.
Thank you, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on your the last slide here, the engine standards, the lead in aviation gasoline. Take your time on that one, by the way. and the nitrogen dioxide. I guess my understanding was the Bush had a extension before they had to switch over to the ultra-low sulfur diesel.
Mm-hmm.
Is that extension, are we going to continue that, or are they going to be forced to switch over to that fuel?
So the federal rules for ultra-low sulfur diesel have phased in over time. And in Alaska, the way that worked, it started in the motor vehicle sector and then went into sort of non-road heavy equipment and marine. And for rural Alaska, I believe rural Alaska transitioned to that fuel in 2010, so a couple of years ago for those purposes. And that was several years later than the rest of the country. So there was some time provided to allow that to happen. And there was a recognition that because of the unique distribution system and storage in rural Alaska, that it made sense to have as many of those requirements happen at the same time as so we could align them, because the way EPA had the rules working, the motor vehicles came 1 year, and then the heavy equipment, and then the locomotive marine came later. So they aligned, we worked with them and they aligned all those, and that transitioned in 2010. I believe for the industrial facilities, the transition has more to do with when new engines go into use. So newer engines may require the newer fuel. And so this new rule, and it's only been out a couple days, so I'm not sure I can give you the exact detail, but I'm sure that part of that is that transition as well for the fuel for those units. And I'm not exactly sure what the date will be for that.
Okay.
That just came out last week, so.
And a quick follow-up. On the ultra-low sulfur fuel, the main concern that I've heard from constituents and neighbors, quite frankly, is you don't have the same amount of lubricity in the fuel. So if you have an engine, of, you know, perhaps, you know, 20, 30 years ago vintage. It wasn't necessarily designed to be able to run on this particular fuel. Are we seeing equipment failures in the state due to the fuel? Or is that not something that you guys necessarily track? And then could you just, after that, just go into the nitrogen dioxide, why it's bad?
Through the chair, Representative Feige. So the first part of the question, I'm not aware of significant issues with equipment using the ULSD. Typically, the fuel distributors will add a lubricant to the fuel to try and address that. I know that with the very oldest engines, when the first transitions for these fuels was coming out, some of them might have needed some seals or some maintenance to try and deal with that. But I'm not aware of any major problems. We don't track it specifically, but I'm not aware of any major problems that I've been hearing of recently with regard to that. So that's that piece. The nitrogen dioxide standard. So the change that happened with nitrogen dioxide is, as I mentioned, EPA regularly updates its National Ambient Air Quality Standards. The Clean Air Act requires them to look at them every 5 years. And the last time they looked at nitrogen dioxide, they made a revision that established a one-hour standard. The prior standard for nitrogen dioxide was an annual standard. So the permitting programs and all of the analysis that's been done related to nitrogen dioxide air pollution, at least within the industrial permitting sector, has been looking at an annual basis. Well, when you look at something on an annual basis, a spike of concentration of nitrogen dioxides here and there evens out over the course of an entire year. But if you have to look at an hour, you're looking at a very different regime where an episode, a short-term episode, could be an issue. So it's created a challenge in the sense that all of our tools have really been set up to look at this longer-term standard, and now we're trying to understand how it works with a shorter-term standard.
Why is nitrogen dioxide bad?
For the reason most air, like many air pollutants, it does have health effects. All the National Ambient Air Quality Standards are set to protect human health. I don't actually have the list of what those human health effects are in my brain right now for nitrogen dioxide, but I'm assuming it would be usually it's respiratory issues.
Right. Thank you, Representative Tuck, then Seaton, and then Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Healy Clean Coal Plant, is this division the one that they've had to meet requirements before they can open back up, or open up, or fire up, however you want to look at it?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, we did issue the air quality permit for the Healy Power Plant. It was the latest action that we took was a renewal of the Title V operating permit. One of the concerns within that renewal, the Healy Clean Coal Plant has been permitted to operate for many years, but one of the concerns was it had been shut down so long that it would trigger a restart policy that EPA had. We did permit that facility, and then it goes through a process of review at EPA, and ultimately EPA and the company came to an arrangement that should allow that to move that project to move forward and open that plant.
Mr. Chair. Is it your division that I know you have an air permit for them now, but is it over the last 10, 11 years, have they not been meeting your permitting process in the past? Is that the reason why they haven't been able to fire up?
Through the chair, no. The startup of that plant has not had any, there's not been any technical issue that I'm aware of related to air permitting that would prevent the restart of the plant. It was other issues that
okay.
were keeping that plant from restarting.
Awesome. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two questions. In your departmental breakdown under the Air Permits Division, how many folks are working on compliance, and do you feel like that's adequate staffing for the number of permits that are issued? And then the second is for the lead in aviation fuel standard. So something like lead, where we know, you know, exposure can cause permanent learning disabilities, are you coordinating with the Department of Health and Social Services in terms of comments, or is one thing, you know, you're addressing one component, and if there's a health component, then they would address that.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, on the resources, I should have brought the numbers for these subgroups. Probably half of those FTEs roughly are in the compliance group. It's I want to say, yeah, probably at least half of them are in the compliance group. I could get you exact numbers if you'd like. Mm-hmm. And they do regular inspections. They have inspection schedules. And so we seem to be keeping up as far as I know. You know, as far, I would say we're keeping up with the compliance and reviews of those permits. A lot of it is paperwork, mm-hmm. Report reviews and things like that, and then we do full compliance evaluations periodically on the different facilities. Mm-hmm. And then on your second question related to lead and aviation gasoline. So with that particular issue, we often coordinate with Department of Health and Social Services on health-related aspects of different rulemakings that are coming out. Or when we're implementing and talking about the health of related to health air pollution health effects, so we often coordinate with them. We're also coordinating in this case with Department of Transportation related to the aviation issues as well. I know the EPA just recently has been funding some lead monitoring in Anchorage here, Merrill Field, to try and better inform the work that's going on in that area. So there's. It's definitely a collaboration often between health and DEC on some of these issues, particularly where they relate to health effects.
Thank you. Appreciate those concerns. Thank you. Representative Seekin, then Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You keep referring to the national standards, and does that mean we don't have primacy, or do we have primacy and we are just enforcing the national standards, not having any Alaska-specific standards?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we do have primacy for air quality. Our standards and a lot of our programs are very much aligned with the federal program, but for example, we've adopted into Alaska regulation ambient air quality standards for particulate matter, for nitrogen dioxide, carbon monoxide, that are essentially identical to the federal standards. It doesn't mean that we can't have our own standard, but we're often very much aligned with the federal standard. If we want to be more restrictive than the federal standard, then we have special regulatory procedures that are required under state statute to do that. So often, if there's a federal counterpart to what we're doing, we're often very much aligned with the federal requirements.
And follow up. And so what I'm hearing you say is that the standards that we have to enforce have to be at least as restrictive as the federal standards. They could be more restrictive, but they have to be at least as restrictive as the federal standards. And I guess the question is on time to issue permits previously, before we had primacy, and now. Can you provide us some comparison? I'm not asking off the top of your head, but I mean, can you provide us some of those comparisons? I'd like to know that for your division and the other divisions of what is the time to issue relationship between before we had primacy and after?
Through the chair, you're correct. Your first statement was correct that we are typically we have to be at least as restrictive as the federal requirement. We can be more restrictive, but we have to at least meet that requirement. As far as being able to give you a comparison pre-primacy to post-primacy, I can look at that, but I think it will be very difficult for us to do that for air quality, because I've been working with air quality for more than 20 years, and we had primacy before I even started working with the department. So, and the changes in the permit structure, the regime, the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 have significantly changed the permitting programs over time. They've evolved federally. So I think it would be very difficult for me to actually prepare that information for you. I doubt we could come up with that information.
Again, if you do happen to come up with anything that you think would be useful for the committee, please pass it through us. We'll make sure it gets out.
Yes,
Representative Hawker, and then we're going to go to the next division.
Yeah, thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chair. Alice, thank you. On that, back to the 1 hour NO2 national ambient standard, what specific industries or businesses in the state of Alaska are going to be compromised by this 1 hour standard versus the annual standard?
through the chair. I guess where we see the most permitting activity, especially construction permitting and Title V permitting, we have obviously the oil and gas sector, industrial facilities in the oil and gas sector, perhaps in the electrical utilities. A lot of our permits are in those areas, and there will be challenges in working through how to demonstrate that their operations will comply with those standards. So those are the issues we're working with. So I guess in short, I think the groups we're working with the most right now are in the oil and gas industry.
Thank you,
Ms. Nolchman. I actually do have two brief questions. One, Ms. Edwards, is there any permit backlog for air permitting analogous to that which was seen in My Line of Water in DNR?
Mr. Chair, the permit backlog that we do have a slight backlog in our operating permits, what we call our Title V operating permits. These are renewed on a 5-year cycle, and so the program started at one particular point in time, so we issued a lot of permits. It was very cyclical, so we had a big slug of permits come in at one time, and so we've been working through those, but I believe we still have probably 18 or 19 permits in the queue for Title V permit renewals. But the way the Title V program works, it doesn't hold up or stop their operations. They continue to operate until, and then they get a new permit. So it doesn't stop them from operating. With the other permits, I think we don't really have a backlog per se of permits in for construction permits or minor permits. Those have been moving through in a fairly timely way. We do have permits in the door, but not a backlog that
I'm glad to hear that. And a second kind of philosophical question briefly. How much of your division's work is enforcement or compliance, and how much is assistance in achieving the standards? Just kind of how much good cop, how much bad cop?
I would say that we prefer to do compliance assistance, so we usually start there. So I would say we have probably more effort going into compliance assistance than we would going into in formal enforcement. Typically, we try to address issues through compliance assistance and less formal enforcement mechanisms. We do issue notices of violation, typically reach settlements, but it's mostly, most of the work is done in inspections, compliance assistance, I would say.
Well, thank you for a lot of good answers to some interesting questions, Ms. Edwards. We call up my friend Eileen Floyd, the acting director of the Division of Environmental Health. And if you'd put yourself in the official record with her name and give us your presentation, we'd looking forward to it.
Thank you, Chairman Sadler. It's nice to be here today to talk about the Division of Environmental Health. My name is Elaine Bussey Floyd, and I am the acting director. We also have a PowerPoint.
Quite a substantial one.
Opportunity for pictures. The division mission for environmental health is the basic safe drinking water, food, and sanitary practices. Our goal is to provide businesses with clear standards so they can protect our environment and provide safe food and drinking water to Alaskans. Our organization is four components, although we show five there because the state veterinarian is actually housed with the environmental health laboratory for budget purposes, but it's a standalone program. The director's office oversees changes to the 9 regulatory chapters that are involved with environmental health. We manage the budget so the resources are used wisely. And we also manage the recreational shellfish beach monitoring pilot program and coordinate tsunami debris efforts for the state. Our drinking water program maintains state primacy for regulating public drinking water systems. They review the construction, installation, and operation plans and enforce engineering standards for public water systems to protect public health and meet Safe Drinking Water Act requirements. We assist public water system owners and operators in identifying the source of their drinking water and help them develop strategies to protect those sources from contamination. Also emergency response and a great deal of technical and compliance assistance. We've had primacy in drinking water since 1978. Mm-hmm. We have 19 federal rules. 2 are pending adoption and 5 more are proposed. It's increasingly challenging to us and the owner-operators to stay on top of the rule requirements, but they're helping our water. So it's a give and take. We do have 1,500 federally designated water systems that serve 25 or more people. A little less than half are year-round and a little over half are seasonal, the lodges and whatnot. Our state-regulated systems that serve 25 people or less but greater than a private well with a home or a duplex, we have 5,000 of those. They are registration, quarterly and annual testing, construction approval is required. That includes residential care facilities, assisted living homes, child care facilities, foster homes, gas stations, office buildings, apartments. So there's a vulnerable population involved there too, not that state employees or other workers aren't vulnerable, but the assisted living homes and the child care facilities, it's really important for public health for those people to have good water. We have 61 employees in the drinking water program in 5 offices throughout the state. And as I mentioned, the increasing complexity of the federal rules for engineering and compliance monitoring continues to be a challenge, but we're working on it. We do a great deal of work with the communities and the public. We use a technical assistance providers group that consists of people from the drink water program, the Village Safe Water Program, Operator Certification and Assistance, the Native Tribal Health Consortium, Rural Business Advisor, Tanana Chiefs Conference, Alaska Rural Water Association, and Alaska Training and Technical Assistance Center, which is a really lot of people that get together, but that provides focused compliance assistance for public water systems. Our pesticide program is housed in the solid waste component, but again, it's a standalone program. It has 5 employees located in 1 office. We have primacy from EPA to implement FIFRA, Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. They conduct inspections to make sure pesticide applications comply with regulations and worker protection standards. They register and monitor the distribution and sale of over 5,000 registered pesticides and products in the state of Alaska, review pesticides for potential risks to water, issue permits for applications to water or aerial application, and on certain state and local requirements.
Briefly.
On that last picture in the last slide?
Yes.
Was that a mattress? What were we looking at over there in the bottom, the previous slide,
Just a second. I've got to figure out how to go back. Maybe backspace.
Is that bed bugs?
Bed bugs, sure.
Yeah, that's bed bugs.
Those cooties.
Okay, that picture is bed bugs. Thank you. So implementing the integrated pest management plan for better management of invasive species or other bugs are invasive to a certain extent, right? We've also are implementing changes to address the difficulty for state agencies, in particular DOT and DNR and the Alaska Railroad, to obtain permits. We've improved the product registration so that that can happen online now. That's streamlining that. And we have regulations that are close to being adopted, very close, all right, to standardize the necessity for a permit between state, federal, and privately owned land. And my example for that would be if there was three tracts of land, one state, one federal, one private, two of them didn't need a permit and the state one did. So we have the ability to change that via regulation, and that's what we're doing. But that's not going to diminish the oversight that we do. It'll actually allow us to have more time for oversight and ensuring that the pesticides are being applied properly and monitoring that. And anybody that's going to apply pesticides has to produce an integrated pest management plan, which just lays out all the procedures that they're going to follow. So we're very happy about that. Our solid waste management program reviews and approves solid waste permits for design, operation, monitoring, management, issues permits for disposal, inspects landfills to verify compliance, enforce violations, and monitor closed landfill sites. We have 15 employees in three offices around the state. 23 of the landfills that are class 1 and 2 that accept 5 tons or more a day are permitted. 100% of the industrial landfills in Alaska are permitted. That's 35 total. 100% of the industrial treatment facilities are permitted, 11, and 33.5% of the rural landfills are permitted out of 188. We, again, are working on implementing regs this year that will simplify the permit application process for village landfills, therefore increasing the number of permitted facilities and improving operations. We've got a lot of compliance and technical assistance that we'll be able to provide to the rural landfills so they can bring their landfills up to standard. It'll dramatically simplify the permitting requirements for the very small landfills. We're doing increased outreach and technical assistance resulted in increased permit percentage from 22% 2 years ago to 33.5% in 2013. So we're confident that the permit reform that we're executing in that area also will benefit the public. Food safety and sanitation. What we do, establish standards, permit, inspect, and enforce standards for food processing and food service facilities, and including seafood processors. We establish standards and inspect on a complaint basis for certain public facilities for sanitation, and we provide education and training on the safe handling of food. Our regulatory and statutory references are there. We have 40 employees in 10 offices. We're responsible for 4,600 restaurants, markets, and food processors, and nearly 800 seafood processors and shellfish harvesters, dealers, and packers. Along with 3,700 public facilities ranging from pools and spas to body art, body piercing shops, barbers and hairdressers, overnight accommodations, public showers. So that's on our sanitation side. By the numbers, we inspected 47% of our high-risk retail food establishments in 2012 and 85% of high-risk seafood establishments. We've also trained staff. There's trained food workers in 73% of the facilities. We've collaborated with the UAF Cooperative Extension Service to give certified public food manager training to places that where a trainer is not already available or the resources are limited. So we've set up online video training and that's been very successful for us. We are, as the commissioner mentioned, we instituted the low-risk food regulation changes this summer that expanded the foods that can be sold direct to the consumer without a permit, including cakes, cookies, fry bread, confections, pickled vegetables. Basically, we took the low-risk foods that, through a combination of their pH and their water activity, that don't generally support the growth of dangerous bacteria, and those are the foods that we're calling the cottage food operation. So we already exempted raw whole vegetables, eggs, jams, jellies, herbal vinegar. That stuff is still exempted, but we also expanded that to the baked goods and pickled vegetables and political fundraisers.
The food's always good there. Okay.
You've got to cook it and serve it immediately. We don't do as many inspections as is recommended by the FDA. We don't get to all of our high-risk facilities every year, even once a year. They recommend we're there multiple times a year. And that's part of the reason that we put the low-risk food out of the permit arena, so that we're available to provide information, but we didn't have to spend time on permitting that, and it made it easier for the public.
Yep.
Our collaboration with the Cooperative Extension, their test kitchen, we, in conjunction with the Office of the State Veterinarian who runs the dairy program, we've conducted training on a VAT pasteurizer that's available for the small milk producers to be able to pasteurize their milk. They don't have to have the whole operation themselves. They can go to the test kitchen. That's been very effective. And the certified food protection manager courses that we've conducted in conjunction with them. And we do a lot of outreach to that little set of initials up there, the Shellfish Growers Association, the Southeast Regional Dive Fisheries, the Alaska Food Safety Advisory Council Committee, and the Alaska Seafood Processors Advisory Committee. I've got to learn how to back this up. Okay. Maybe. There we go. Okay. I wanted to talk about the picture that says Germ City. We have in collaboration with, let me think, Fred Meyer, the Food Safety Advisory Committee, and the Cooperative Extension and the Washington State Cooperative Extension, we debuted Germ City at the Tanana Valley State Fair in Fairbanks last summer and demonstrated it at the Governor's Picnic and other events around to physically illustrate the importance that hand washing plays in lowering the frequency of foodborne illness. Germ City is an interactive science-based program that's designed for use with all ages. Basically, you go up to the booth and they give you some non-toxic lotion to rub on your hands that you can't see it. But when you go under the black light, your hands look, they all light up. Then you go in and wash your hands, or you go out and wash your hands the way you normally would, and you come back and check the black light. Well, usually your hands are still glowing. So you get to go back and wash your hands as many times as necessary, which really drives home the point of extensive hand washing and how important it is, because the fingernails and in between the fingers. Anyway, it's very visual and it's pretty fun.
That was set up right by the free flu shot booth at the fair.
Positioning is everything.
Location.
Yes. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, hand washing is the single most important barrier to the spread of foodborne disease. There's a clear need to communicate risk and enhance motivation for hand washing, and that's what Germ City does. So we're really happy that we have that as part of our outreach. We had it set up last week at the public health meetings that were held at the Captain Cook. Always popular. Also, no, that covers it for food. The state veterinarian. They are everywhere with our animals. Five employees, two offices. They provide technical assistance, permit, inspect, and monitor for dairy and livestock producers. They permit and monitor the movement of animals and animal biological products, which is vaccines, surveillance and control of animal diseases. You'll see them at the fairs every year, testing for avian influenza and other diseases, you know, where animals gather. They respond to animal health emergencies, and they also are responsible for our fish tissue monitoring program, so they're collecting samples and evaluating those for contaminants in conjunction with the environmental health lab. They have maintained our state's disease-free status, allowing easy international and interstate animal transport, and helping keep commercial and private animal owners healthy and free of disease. That pasteurizer is mentioned here now. We also permitted a new dairy processing facility in the Mat Valley, which was timely. And I'm going to move on to the Environmental Health Lab, who has 23 employees in one location. They certify 88 private laboratories to perform compliance and regulatory testing for drinking water contaminated sites and dairy. They also do over 60,000 testing processes on a variety of things, from contaminant monitoring, air filters for the Division of Air, animal health, drinking water, and foodborne illnesses. We have only three federal agencies that we're directly responsible to, but it's seven completely different federal programs for certification. More than the public health lab has to answer to. Having in-state testing avoids time delays and cost of shipping. We do offer services that are not provided by the private sector because some federal law mandates the government lab. PSP testing is one of those. We received a FDA grant to obtain ISO certification, ISO accreditation for food testing. A five-year grant at $1.5 million that will bring us up to the international standards, which are optional at this point but will become mandatory to enable us to it standardizes the quality and management requirements, and it strengthens it gives us legally defensible data on which regulatory action can be taken. So it's just it's an A-plus rating for the lab when we achieve that. And I want to close with tsunami marine debris. The governor signed an administrative order in July last year that designated DEC as the lead agency to coordinate the multi-agency effort related to tsunami-generated marine debris. We are seeing large quantities of debris that we haven't seen before in this state. Our concerns about that is the potential toxicity of the components, the smothering of sensitive habitats, mm-hmm. the small styrofoam pieces, the effect of that on marine and terrestrial life, disposal, safety risk to the removal crews. Wanted to say about this picture, especially the one in the upper left, that pile of styrofoam there was not gathered by the removers. It was the ocean did that. The surf washed it up and deposited it in a pile. And then the other pictures show it spread out more, and you can see with the logs and whatnot, it's there's lots of places for it to hide. We have just to give you an idea, we contracted for an aerial survey last year that produced over 8,000 pictures on 2,000 miles of our coastline was surveyed, and each picture was individually graded for debris density and type of debris. That allowed us to demonstrate that we have significantly more debris than was originally forecast in the modelings. Our coastline is vast. It's very difficult to access. So we demonstrated a pretty significant need. The allocation of the $5 million from the government of Japan is going to take place by each of the five states and two territories receiving an initial small allocation, and then after submission of a statement of work, but then subsequent statements of work will be need-based and approved by NOAA on a case-by-case basis, and that's good for Alaska, because if it had been an initial disbursement of $1 million to each state, we've got more coastline and more debris and more difficulty to access it. So that was a very good move for us that it went like that. That concludes my presentation.
With the Committee's indulgence, I'm going to ask a brief question on that topic, and maybe Ms. Edwards is a better person. Can you burn styrofoam on the beach? Is there an air quality or a residual environmental quality issue? It's high volume, you know,
yes.
Low weight.
Yes, you can't burn it.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
Because yes. It doesn't burn, or because it's bad burn?
Bad for the air.
Bad stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. I have Representative Wilson and Representative Feck and Feige. And Tar.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I've got three questions.
Okay.
they're fast answers.
Okay.
Where was the tsunami debris most prevalent? What part of the state? And was there any radioactivity in any of it?
No radioactivity. Much of it has been sporadically or randomly tested, and there's been no signs of radioactivity on any debris that's here. And the greatest prevalence is in the Montague Island, Kayak Island, Gore Point, Kodiak, Homer. It's the Gulf, okay, and Southeast. Literally every single picture that was taken from the lower end of the panhandle, Cape Muzan, around to the Alaska Peninsula had tsunami-related debris in it. Very extensive. Through the chair, sorry.
And then follow up. In one of the, you know what, when you do these, if you put page numbers, it would help.
Sure thing. Yes.
But one of the pages, 85%, you said 85% of the inspections had been completed in 2012. And I was just, I just want to hear you say it up for the record, I assume that when you start in again this year, that you will catch the rest of them that you didn't get last year before you go to a bunch of other ones.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Yes, we do look at that, and we also do the seafood establishments under contract with the FDA. So we work with the FDA to determine which ones Alaska's going to do and which ones they're going to do. So so they are all covered.
Okay, and my last one.
For seafood processors.
And I'm interested in with the TB test for reindeer, and you said that you did a blood test. And I know with a regular TB test, you have to wait 3 days and then check it out again. And can you find out immediately with the blood test, or is there a waiting period there also?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I don't know that answer,
okay.
But I will get it for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And actually, my two questions are already asked, but a follow-up question to the radioactivity. Is there any testing of the fish? Because there has been some news articles that talked about the breakup of the plastics that may have been radioactive and then the fish being able to consume that. Is there any plan or any forecast or even any need to test some of the fish?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we don't have any evidence at all or any prediction that the radioactivity from Japan is affecting the fish that arrive in Alaska. So Alaskan's fish, we don't feel a need to test them, no.
Okay.
We also don't have baseline data for background, the small background radiation levels, so it would be information that would be incomplete.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Feige, quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under your pesticide program, are pesticides and herbicides all wrapped up in the same set of regulations? Okay.
Yes, Representative Feige.
I understand talking to some of the farmers in my district. There's one of the suggestions that they had for apparently there's a list of herbicides that are approved for use in Alaska. I'm correct, right?
Okay. Yes, sir.
One of the things they suggested was that because there's basically a fairly limited number of herbicides that are available, and there's herbicides that are not on the list that would work, is there a process for adding those particular herbicides to the list? Who does that, and is that something that's, is it a particularly onerous process, or do they just have to petition for it? What's the...
Representative Feige, through the chair, I don't know that.
Okay.
But I will definitely find out.
Yeah, one of the suggestions they had was basically, I guess there's a fair amount of testing that has to be done to say that it's safe. That same testing is done in other states. So it, would it be possible to simply adopt some other state, say like Washington or Oregon, adopt their list to allow our farmers more flexibility in their herbicide use? That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you. One last question, Representative Tower, then we're going to go to the next divisions.
Mm-hmm.
Representative
Tower. On that point, actually, the chemical manufacturers have to apply for that. So that would be the way they would get onto the list. And they choose not to apply in Alaska because it's so low volume. I wanted to just congratulate you on adopting the IPP approach for the railroad issue. Certainly really controversial as people access that right away for subsistence harvesting. And just... two things. On the landfill, are we monitoring for off-gassing at any of our older landfills, some of the ones that have development on top of them? And then second, on the food compliance issues, now that we're doing the voluntary reporting and we're not able to inspect as many facility, you know, all of the facilities on an annual basis, do we know how many additional staff it would take to be able to work through and do at least one annual inspection?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the off-gassing question I'm going to have to research for you,
mm-hmm.
and the number of inspectors that we need. We've worked up numbers before. We have a 10-year plan that is part of our, it's in the long-range plan, and we update that regularly. We would need a significant number of inspectors, but we are trying now to just streamline and get more efficient so that we can make do with what we have as best as we can.
Great. Thank you very much, Eileen. Appreciate your answering the questions. We now have 30 minutes left in two divisions, so I'm going to call Larry Diedrich to talk about SPAR. You had the most impressive slide deck we've seen yet this, this short year, so would you like a cup of coffee before you begin your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Diedrich, Director of the Division of Spill Prevention Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Thank you for your patience and your endurance. Okay, well, we'll go ahead and start. I'll try to be brief and keep it to the 15. And is it the arrows you're using here? There we go. Okay. Our mission is to protect public health and the environment through prevention, preparedness, and response to oil and hazardous substance releases. That's the overall mission of the division. This next slide is just shows you a continuum of our overall responsibilities, which we use prevention. We have some prevention regulations, preparedness for oil and hazardous substance releases. We actually respond then to releases that occur. And the ones that are not cleaned up in an immediate basis then become contaminated sites, for which we also have a program. We have four programs in the division that meet these four major goals. One is the Prevention and Emergency Response Program. One is the Industry Preparedness Program. We have a Contaminated Sites Program, and then we also manage the Response Fund. And so the presentation is in the order of these programs, and we'll just continue moving. This is the qualifications. You can look at this at your leisure. I would flag one piece of information on here. Our senior leadership for the program, the four program managers, myself, have about 159 years of collective experience and a wide variety of educational and experience backgrounds. So we've got a very seasoned, experienced crew with average years of experience for our senior team at 31 years. That also may send signals about something else. The first program, the Prevention Emergency Response Program, this is the program that actually responds to releases of oil and hazardous substances, and that's their mission. They also deal with the cleanup, mitigation of impacts, and restoration of damaged resources. To put things in perspective for our spills in Alaska, the green area is the 17-year history since we've been keeping records in a digital format electronically for spill reports. They're averaging a little over 2,000 a year, and then the dashed line is the numbers in recent times here. So you can see the trend compared to the historic average has gone down a little bit. It gives you an idea of the number that we have historically. Of the total spills that occur historically, diesel is the biggest release we have in the state. Aviation fuel, gasoline, hydraulic oil are the other three key items that are spilled, and then everything else is in the other category. The crude oil, by the way, is in the other category. Our crude oil spills really, except for some exceptional ones, is low. This is what this program does. They do the emergency response. We also manage a statewide hazmat response. They conduct drills and exercises. They prepare our government oil spill response plans. They maintain local spill response agreements, so we have first response capability in all areas of the state, and they also coordinate the department's response to disaster declarations. We have three response teams. There's one for Northern Alaska, Central Alaska, and Southeast. And these are the guys that are available around the clock. Our hazmat, the statewide hazmat team, this effort started in 1997. The state had virtually no hazmat response capability. This is a capability where, worst case, you need a complete encapsulated suit with SCBA to respond to our worst case releases. The top two hazardous substances in the state to respond to is ammonia and chlorine. We have since expanded this group out on an ad hoc basis to include over 26 organizations in the state. We have every major response organization in the state now that are part of our hazmat response work group, including military, civilian, fire service districts, etc. And I would like to be able to think that we have the ability to handle any hazmat release in the state in any location. And this state team has been standardized. We have standard protocols. We have flyout kits. And we can tap different levels of expertise. The 103rd gives us ability to respond to military-type releases, UXO, and those kinds of things. This is just the oil spill response capability. This is a structure that shows how the plans are all pulled together, federal, state. We have a unified plan in Alaska that combines federal and state response planning requirements into one, and then those are merged with the industry spill planning containments or contingency plans. And it all ends up in one single unified response using the incident command system. Local response agreements, this chart just shows locations of where we have agreements and have pre-positioned equipment on a risk-based basis in certain areas of the state that are generally remote where we don't have a pre-existing response capability. This allows us to use local response, local knowledge, and local resources then to activate an immediate response. Some of their activities, to give you a feel for the type and kind of work, there's about 821 responses out of 1,800 and some spill reports last year. 23 ranked significant. Number of spills, spill drills and exercises. We're prepared geographic response strategies, which are site-specific response plans in high-risk areas. We update our plans, and we're participating in marine vessel risk assessments in Southeast Alaska, Cook Inlet, and the Aleutians. We've also been doing quite a bit with Arctic offshore drilling and Arctic shipping preparedness in this group. This will give you an idea of the ocean area that has to be responded to. The blue area is the Alaska Exclusive Economic Zone, go out to 200 miles. It's truncated on the west by the international dateline. That's the area of responsibility for which our response plans in Alaska are built out to that limit. This is also interesting because you can see the size of Alaska's ocean area in comparison to all of the other U.S. ocean areas, including the territories, and how Alaska really dwarfs even the lower 48, the continental U.S. in terms of ocean area. It's very significant. Shipping, maritime incidents are a big risk in Alaska. These shows the major shipping routes, the Great Circle route in the upper left, goes through Unimak Pass. We get all the Pacific trade that's originating from the Pacific West Coast and the North American continent come our way. A lot of these vessels are in instant passage. They don't comply with U.S. or state requirements and therefore do not have the capability to respond according to U.S. standards. The lower left is simply the traffic in Southeast, which is our high-density cruise ship traffic. We've just done a Southeast vessel traffic study and are looking at the Panamax ships, which is really our worst-case risk in the state, is a large cruise ship with 5,000 people. And the Costa Concordia, you sink, you spill oil, and oil and water with people is definitely the worst case scenario.
They don't mix.
Yeah. And we have the largest maritime casualty on the west coast of North America happened just north of Juneau here, 354, I think. Sophia. So we have a bad history, so to speak, of marine casualties in the state. Cook Inlet, there's risk assessment being done. You can see all those track lines show the predominant vessel traffic routes that's used then in the planning for prevention measures. And the new routes from the Arctic, then, you can see is the Northern Sea Route, which has been the one that's had 46 ships come through this year. Northwest Passage isn't quite so consistent in opening up, but you can see at the top they all pass through the Bering Straits, which proposes a new set of risks. It goes right through the state's Bering Sea fishery, one of our largest commercial resources. The response challenges, I won't go through this. You can look at it, the operational considerations, the logistics, and the risks, and the expectation for responding. Now, the response system in the state is pretty mature, and we do have the ability to respond 24/7 to virtually any spill in the state at any location. And I don't say that just for us. I say that for us, industry, and our federal agency counterparts. These are just some of the marine casualties, the Kirishima, the Exxon, the Cougar Ace, Sandang IUC, Bulk Pride, and Golden Seas. We're working on a conceptual vessel rescue system because maritime risks, and these are the components of the system, and this actually is reflective of the recent incident in Kodak. You have a vessel, what happens is they lose power. And so the problem is if they lose power, if you can't intercept them, then they go aground. So drift groundings is the primary risk. They go aground and then they spill. And so we have emergency towing systems that we've invested in now at the state, two of which were placed on the Cullic. You need a tug of vessel of opportunity, which is where we're generally weak statewide. And you need a place of refuge to take these things to get them out of bad conditions. And we just completed the first mooring buoy for in a place of refuge in Dutch Harbor. Having ships blowing the wind down there is not a new thing, and we did the design for that. Shell and others helped and put that system in. It was just recently completed. Incidents, again, just more incidents. We had a gas blowout on the North Slope. The Overseas Ohio in the upper right there is actually a crude oil tanker that hit an iceberg in Prince William Sound in 1995. It drives home the damage that ice can cause, so that's still an ongoing concern in certain areas of the state. We also coordinate the disaster breakup. This is the Eagle Yukon breakup. Industry preparedness. This is the group that ensures that our producers, transporters, and distributors of oil prevent spills, are able to clean them up. They review and approve contingency plans, and the state and federal government has a financial responsibility requirement. This just gives you an idea of the regulated community. Here, the crude oil at the top, all of those facilities are required to have C plans, and then below the lower half is the non-crude facilities are required to have contingency plans, and the items in the circle are the parts of the infrastructure, the oil, gas, storage, transportation infrastructure that are not yet regulated. Pipelines are a very big component of the oil gas infrastructure. It's estimated about 80% of the infrastructure is pipelines. So the state reviews now the flow lines, which is a very big component that are not, these flow lines are not otherwise regulated. They're the highest risk of the pipelines because they're carrying three-phase fluids. The state is now regulating those, and this is a part of an aging infrastructure. Stay on top of this. This is a key component we're keeping an eye on. I won't go through this. This is just details and on exact portions of the oil infrastructure that are regulated, and there are specific points in the system where the regulation starts and stops, usually at a valve, and it could be a storage tank, a secondary containment, a crude oil line, or a flow line. Spills at regulated versus unregulated facilities. Unregulated facilities are causing about 73% of spills versus regulated, so that's a good indicator for how industry is performing in Alaska. Industry, their responsibilities, again, they review the contingency plans, do drills and inspections, approve the financial responsibility. We also approve the oil spill primary response action contractors, and they review best available technology. Again, this is, these are just images of the types of facilities that are regulated. It also includes the railroad, any escort system in Prince William Sound. And we have on our second drill rig down Cook Inlet, which is a good thing. First one last year, and now we have another one coming up here. We have six co-ops. Those are just the logos for the co-ops and many drills. Offshore drilling is a very big item. A lot of time and attention going into this now with well capping systems, subsea containment systems. We're waiting to see what the federal government does through BSEE in terms of coming out with new regulations that will apply to offshore drilling. These are some of their bean counts from last year in the terms of number of contingency plan actions, inspections, drills. We also hosted a pipeline leak detection technology conference, trying to get a better handle on leak detection systems. The earlier the detection, the better the response, the less the impacts. These are just some of the aging infrastructure issues. We've had frozen pipelines. Pigging systems are being retrofitted. The original systems were old enough that a lot of the flow lines didn't have those kinds of systems. There's an enormous amount of work and energy going in on part of the industry and the inspectors in terms of overseeing this and trying to stay ahead of the power curve on the aging components. Contaminated site program. The spills that don't get thoroughly cleaned up, which are usually the spills to land and go subsurface, are handed off to the Contaminate Site Program, who then does the assessment, cleanup, and monitoring and redevelopment of what we call contaminated sites. This is the total number for the state. We've got that many known open sites. You can see the number are closed. We're trying to bring that down as fast as we can. There's quite a few sites in Alaska, and a lot of these are of legacy origin. Here's what the spill, the breakout between spills to water, which is the green, and spills to land. So a lot of the ones that go subsurface are not become project management and are longer haul cleanups. The legacy sites, of which we have many in the state, that's a shot of Umiat and the drums from the early exploration in NPRA in 1963, which is undergoing major cleanup efforts now, trying to get this taken care of. The legacy contamination, we figure, is about 97% of our contaminated sites are from legacy activities in the state, mining, logging, fuel storage, World War II, Cold War sites around the coast, leaking underground storage tanks, which we originally had about 6,000 and 7,000. 6,000 had been removed now under a 10-year program. Here's the ownership of the contaminated sites. About half of them are owned by the federal government, either civilian or military. The private has about 33% of them, and then the rest are between the state and local. These are the locations of the federal facilities. Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Federal civilian. What's a federal civilian? Like FAA, for example, just federal non-military? Okay, pick it up.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes. We split. The DOD has a substantial cleanup program in the state of Alaska, and then the federal civilian agencies do as well. Their responsibilities then are to manage these sites and oversee their cleanup. There's a variety of tools they use to do this. Some cases, if we have a widespread groundwater contamination, it becomes an area-wide cleanup. It's not locked to just a single property owner. We have a big focus on reuse and redevelopment of the sites. Some of the box stores in Fairbanks are built over prior contaminated sites, and so we've had a pretty good degree of success in getting these sites cleaned up or mitigated to the point where they can be reused, which is ultimately what we want to do. We use risk-based cleanups, and we also have established standards. This is a risk continuum, just to show you that the contaminated sites, the subsurface ones, are not at the top of the list where they're posing an acute public health thing. Most of these are down lower on the spectrum here. where they either present a chronic ecological risk, possible chronic public health risk, and some of these aren't even in the chronic. They're just a fuel source that's in the ground that's locked up, that's not moving and not going anywhere, not hurting anything. So we approach the cleanups and the rigor of the cleanups based on this kind of approach, which we call the risk-based approach. We use exposure pathways, which is to find out, okay, where that contamination is, what is the pathway to contaminating either the environment or public health, and if you can sever that pathway and provide the protection, that is a tool that's used frequently when you can't otherwise clean up a site because it's technically not possible or economically not possible. Photo on the right is a land farm on the north slope for remediation of oil-contaminated waste. That's over by the east dock. And this one on the left is another example of a groundwater intercept down on the Kenai, which is right adjacent to Cook Inlet. So some of these projects are fairly significant. Here's their counts on their activity for FY12, about 1,200 sites where we've taken actions. 154 sites with risk reduction measures, 161 new sites, assessments and risk evaluations, 19 brownfield, which are the reuse sites. And our contaminants concern, we've got some solvents and sulfalene are kind of at the top of the list now. Again, that's just an example of abandoned drums. And the other is a bunker site, which we still have in the state in the coastal areas, typical cleanups. This is a plume over the Fairbanks area of groundwater contamination that we're monitoring that's headed over towards the Chena River. Last program is Response Fund Administration then. They manage the response fund on a sustainable basis as it's intended by statute. And that includes, in addition to management of the fund, cost recovery, contract management. They act as the emergency finance section during emergency responses. They prepare the biennial response fund reports and run their information databases. I won't go into this. This is just a schematic of the response fund for the response and prevention account. Here's some of their activities for the last fiscal year in terms of cost recovery. $4.2 million in state contracts to private firms whom we have term contracts with to conduct the cleanups. And so on. You can look at those at your leisure, I guess. We have 11 term contracts in place and 100 notices to proceed for the last year. So we use the private sector quite extensively in doing the work. A couple of the highlights then for last year, we did participate on the U.S. delegation to the Arctic Council, which is going to result in an eight Arctic nation mutual response agreement for the Arctic. That will be presented to the Arctic Council ministers in May of 2013. And we will then have a mutual aid agreement for the Arctic Ocean for the future. We also participated on the incident review for the Gulf of Mexico spill with the U.S. Coast Guard team. We've formed an Arctic Oil Spill Caucus with Yukon Northwest Territories under the PENWAR, who I think some of you are familiar with, Pacific Northwest Economic Region. And we're doing risk assessments in four different areas now. And we've got an Arctic Pipeline Technology Forum scheduled for this fall. And with that, I'm sure I'm past my time, so I'll wrap it up there, Mr. Chairman. And
I appreciate it, Mr. Dietrich. I'm sorry for the hustle up there. I'm sure there might be questions. To be fair to the final division, I wonder if we could hold questions on this division and for the current. And I've got a meeting here, and this room is occupied at 3:15 for Labor and Commerce, but we could roll maybe till 10 after 3 if other members can't attend and the directors can remain.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Water underlies us all, especially in Juneau, so.
Or on top.
On top of, yeah. All around us.
Again on Friday.
Yes. Oh, this is true. So, this is true.
So, what do I hit? I just hit this.
Yeah, front and back.
Okay.
Do you want to put your name in the record and give us your presentation? Thank you.
My name is Michelle Bonnet Hale, and I'm the Director of the Division of Water, DEC's Division of Water. Thank you for... Yeah. The opportunity. I'll probably not speak to every slide, but just try to give some highlights and then be open to some questions. In a nutshell, our mission is to protect water quality and to assist communities in improving sanitation conditions. And to do that, we have a couple of separate parts of the division. So in the Division of Water, we do everything water except regulate drinking water, which Elaine spoke about. And then we don't deal with water quantity, and that's done by the division or the Department of Natural Resources, so water rights, in stream flow reservations. So as you can see, we have two main parts of the division. We have the facilities parts of the division, and that's where our Village Safe Water Program is, and then we have the water quality side of the division. And we've got the FTEs in the different main programs, so facilities has 5 in municipal grants and loans, 12 in Village Safe Water, et cetera. So that's in your packet. What I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about facilities programs and then move on and speak about the water quality programs as well. So core services are grants, loans, and engineering assistance, the Village Safe Water Program, training operators, and providing remote maintenance worker assistance. Municipal grants and loans, they're state matching grants, and those are the grants part of the program. There's also a loans program, and the grants and the loans are for very similar systems, drinking water systems, building drinking water systems, wastewater systems, solid waste facilities. In the loans program, we have the Clean Water Fund and the Drinking Water Fund, and sometimes those are hard to tell apart, but basically the Clean Water Fund is talking about, you know, water that wastewater goes into. We want to keep that water clean, and then the drinking water is actually about people, the water that people drink. And one thing that's important, it sometimes gets confusing, we have the drinking water division, or the environmental health division that regulates drinking water, and then the division of water also has this drinking water loan fund. And our role is really in building the systems and helping the communities build the systems so that they can actually have drinking water. The Village Safe Water Program also builds facilities. These are 100% grants for communities. These are typically villages. The program provides, not only do we provide the grants to build the facilities, but we also provide assistance in engineering, design, planning. So funding sources are EPA, USDA, and the state. It's a 75% federal, 25% state match. Right now, we're at $40 million a year. And I have a slide and a couple of slides that will show the gap that the commissioner spoke about between basically how the funding has gone down and then the gap that we actually have between funding availability and the actual need.
That's $30 million federal, 10 state. That's the total, right?
You know, I don't know if that's the total federal dollars or if that's the total dollars, and I'll get back to you with that information. So as I said, we do not just building the system, but we assist with engineering, planning, design. And one of the really important things about the Village Safe Water grants and the program is that those systems are built in the local communities and they create local jobs. It's very important for a lot of the local communities, as well as training. This slide, many of you have probably seen this diagram demonstrating the gap between funding and need. And this slide not only shows the decline in funding, but also shows the widening gap. So right now, the gap between funding and need is about $667 million. And that gap keeps growing, as you can see. It looks like in 2006, the gap was $339 million. And we've had some bumps, but it typically grows. We have the Operations Assistance Program, and this program is they're tasked with making sure that the operators of the drinking water treatment systems and the wastewater treatment systems are certified. Again, this ties with some of what Elaine talked about, because those systems also have to comply with a lot of drinking water and wastewater standards, but we train the operators, or we make sure they get the training they need and then do the testing. You've also, I'm sure, heard about the remote maintenance worker program, and these are the people that go to the small communities to help actually run the plants, and they provide over-the-shoulder assistance in fixing problems. So they don't necessarily go in and fix the problems themselves, but they work with the people in the local communities. So it's both fixing problems and training opportunities. We also have a remote monitoring pilot project. And we've got a couple of pilot projects where using the internet and using electronic abilities or capabilities, we've got people in Anchorage and Bethel that can actually run and troubleshoot some of the facilities in the remote communities. And that's actually, I think it's going really well and has great potential for us in the state. And these are just a list of communities that we did emergency responses to in 2012. Those emergency responses, they're freeze-up kind of responses, but also big equipment breakdowns. We're pretty proud of our village, our VSW workers, or RMW, I should say. A little bit about the water quality programs. We have four major programs, and that's on that organization chart that I showed you initially. There's the cruise ship program, the wastewater discharge permitting program, the water quality standards program, and compliance. So core services are essentially what we do is we establish water quality standards, and then we use those standards to assess the quality of our waters and to issue permits, set limits and permits. Facilities do self-monitoring for those permits, and they report those results to us. We also have a compliance program where we provide compliance assistance to people who are having trouble maybe complying with the permit. And then finally, we can do enforcement if we need to. The cruise ship program, the four major components of that are the Ocean Rangers program. We monitor air emissions, have wastewater permits, and have had a science advisory panel for the last couple of years. The Ocean Rangers, we have Ocean Rangers on vessels. They were on 88% of the voyages in 2012 with more than 1,500 total reports. It's been a real emphasis to try to get as many Alaskan Ocean Rangers as possible. And in 2012, 7 of the 21 Ocean Rangers deployed were Alaskans. The Science Advisory Panel was established in 2009 by the legislature. There were 11 members on that panel. That panel was tasked with reviewing the effectiveness of treatment on board ships now, as well as looking at new technologies. There's an error on this slide. The technology workshop was in 2012 and not in 2013. And there was a preliminary report to the legislature that was submitted by the commissioner. That included the Science Advisory Panel's report. Moving on to wastewater discharge permitting. If you discharge wastewater at all in the state, you're required to have a permit. Primarily, we permit industry and municipal domestic wastewater treatment plants. So the industries are timber industry, mining, oil and gas, seafood processing, construction. But there's a lot of other oddballs as well. You know, the Sea Life Center has to have a permit because they discharge wastewater, for example. I know you're quite familiar, I'm sure, with the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program. That program, the department's or the division is very proud of. We have maintained that in a series of, or we have assumed that program from the EPA in a series of four phases. The final phase was in October of 2012, so we have full authority for that program now. EPA retains oversight, but we issue permits, we do our compliance actions. We, as the commissioner said, it is a maturing program, but we're really pleased with how well it's maturing, so it's come a long way. In the calendar year 2012, we issued almost 1,300 general permit authorizations, 7 individual permits, and 4 general permits. We put a lot of focus on permitting efficiencies. We've had an online application system in place now for probably a good 6 years. In 2012, we had more than 1,500 online submittals, and that includes permit applications, but also required report submittals, notices of termination for construction general permits. Another type of permit that we're quite proud of is the construction general permit. Essentially, you can apply for that permit online and sign your application electronically, and that way DEC has the information, has the application information. The application is posted automatically on the web by the next day, and within 7 days, people receive automatic authorization. So we can always go back and look at that. We can ask for more information, but if we don't, people are automatically authorized. We also have the Water Quality Standards Assessment and Restoration Program. Our water quality standards are developed by DEC. EPA has to approve those standards, and the commissioner spoke about that. The water quality standards are used to make sure, to understand the health of the water, to assess and evaluate the health of the water, and also to establish discharge limits and permits. We routinely review and update the standards, and again, any changes we make have to be approved by EPA. Also, any changes that we make to those standards go through a rigorous state rulemaking process, and then EPA has to approve. We have the assessment program, which we have baseline water quality monitoring programs for marine and fresh water, and we have targeted assessment to determine if there's impairment or to document restoration. Restoration, we have the Alaska Clean Water Actions Grant Program. We've just recently put our grant notice out. So these grants are for monitoring, for local ordinances, but also for restoring areas that have been determined to be impaired, and education projects. And I think the education projects really ties to the next little bullet, which is prevention, because obviously the best thing we can do is prevent impairment in the first place. So we've got campaigns like the Fuel Out, Fish On campaign, where we get everybody that gets a fishing license, actually for a couple of years, got a little Fuel Out, Fish On card in the mail with the fishing license. We have a compliance program, and as I said, our facilities self-report. We review the data. We have a pretty robust inspection program where we go out and inspect facilities, but also inspect things like construction stormwater sites, provide a lot of compliance and assistance, and then have basically an escalating enforcement policy. So we'll start, if people aren't doing what they need to do, we'll start with an NOV, and we can take formal enforcement actions when we need to. 154 inspections during 2012, 24 notices of violation. And I think I set the record for speed. Hopefully I didn't speak too quickly.
No, that's fine. Thank you. Sorry for the compression. Any quick questions for the director from the committee? No, with that, then, thank you very much, Ms. Hale. Thank you, Commissioner Harding, and your members. Actually, we will be seeing you very shortly back in the same bat time, same station here on Friday. We are going to be hearing on next committee hearing is Friday at 1 p.m., where we'll be hearing House Bill 80, which has to do with cruise ship discharge, wastewater discharge. That's been it. We are adjourned at 3:05.